Welcome to Why Is This Good, a podcast by the Naples Writers Workshop. I'm Christine and I'm here with John. Hey, John.
Hello.
All right, it's your turn to pick a story. Tell us what you picked.
I picked a story called The Celestial Omnibus by E.M. Forster. It had two horses whose sides were still smoking from their journey, and its two great lamps shone through the fog against the alley's walls, changing their cobwebs and moss into tissues of fairyland. The driver was huddled up in a cape. He faced the blank wall, and how he had managed to drive in so neatly and so silently was one of the many things that the boy never discovered, nor could he imagine how ever he would drive out. "Please," his voice quavered through the foul brown air. "Please, is that an omnibus?" "Omnibus est," said the driver, without turning round. There was a moment's silence. The policeman passed, coughing, by the entrance of the alley. The boy crouched in the shadows, for he did not want to be found out. He was pretty sure, too, that it was a pirate. Nothing else, he reasoned, would go from such odd places and at such odd hours. "About when do you start?" he tried to sound nonchalant. "At sunrise." "How far do you go?" "The whole way." "And can I have a return ticket, which will bring me all the way back?" "You can." "Do you know, I half think I'll come." The driver made no answer. The sun must have risen, for he unhitched the brake, and scarcely had the boy jumped in before the omnibus was off. How? Did it turn? There was no room. Did it go forward? There was a blank wall. Yet it was moving, moving at a stately pace through the fog, which had turned from brown to yellow. The thought of warm bed and warmer breakfast made the boy feel faint. He wished he had not come. His parents would not have approved. He would have gone back to them if the weather had not made it impossible. The solitude was terrible. He was the only passenger, and the omnibus, though well built, was cold and somewhat musty. He drew his coat round him, and in so doing chanced to feel his pocket. It was empty. He had forgotten his purse. "Stop," he shouted, "stop." And then, being of a polite disposition, he glanced up at the painted notice board so that he might call the driver by name. "Mr. Brown, stop. Oh, do please stop." Mr. Brown did not stop, but he opened a little window and looked in at the boy. His face was a surprise, so kind it was and modest. "Mr. Brown, I've left my purse behind. I've not got a penny. I can't pay for the ticket. Will you take my watch, please? I am in the most awful hole." "Tickets on this line," said the driver, "whether single or return, can be purchased by coinage from no tarrying mint, and a chronometer, though it had solaced the vigils of Charlemagne or measured the slumbers of Laura, can acquire by no mutation the double cake that charms the fangless Cerberus of heaven." So saying, he handed in the necessary ticket, and, while the boy said, "Thank you," continued, "Titular pretensions, I know it well, are vanity, yet they merit no censure when uttered on a laughing lip, and in an homonymous world are in some sort useful, since they do serve to distinguish one Jack from his fellow. Remember me, therefore, as Sir Thomas Brown."
How'd you find this, or had you read it before?
No, I never read it before. Obviously, I've heard of E.M. Forster. I don't know if I've read anything of his, but I was reading something totally like a work of literary criticism, and it referred to the story. And I was like, "Oh, that sounds interesting. I want to read that story." And so I thought, I'll just find it and we'll do it on the podcast. That'll be an excuse to read it.
Nice.
I read it first before I sent it, but no, I had never heard of it before.
Yeah, it reminded me of the Harry Potter night bus, the Polar Express. And then it also reminded me of the story that we did recently where the kid shows his therapist outside for the first time.
Oh yeah, Isaac Asimov. Yeah.
Yeah. So they like the night bus and the Polar Express, you know. Harry Potter's a little different, but the night bus is like this terrifying bus, you know, that like is going through the streets of like London or whatever, and there's no room for it, but it's squeezing between things. Basically, it's just like a terrifying journey, right? And there's like magical properties to the bus. And the Polar Express is like, you know, it picks up kids to go to the North Pole. Like, we know that's not a thing, but like maybe if you're a kid, you believe it. And then like when this kid is showing his like therapist around outside, and the therapist is like, "You know what? Like, I do remember outside being kind of cool. Like, thanks for showing
Yeah.
me." They all have like a quality about them though, where the celestial omnibus is, it's for the innocent
Or for people
who believe.
who believe, who really like, this is making that contrast between the pedant, the literary critic, and the person who truly enjoys reading and enjoys literature. And like, I don't know if that's necessarily innocence, but it's like, it's something like it.
It's like the opposite of cynicism.
Yeah. It's like the opposite of pedantry.
Yeah. I mean, like either way, we agree that this is something where you're not going to enjoy it a whole lot unless you can believe it or be in the moment without like that critical eye. When he takes Mr. Bonds, he's very much just like, I want to show you this great and exciting thing. And Mr. Bonds goes into it with expectations, you know, which maybe are his first problem.
Notice that Mr. Bonds is snob spelled backwards.
Yeah, snob. So Mr. Snob, he kind of goes into it like with an expectation, and this kid has kind of told him what he's seen, you know, so he's doubtful, but also goes into it thinking this is exactly how I'll handle it. This is who I want to talk to and who's worth talking to.
It's like this kid has befriended Achilles, right? And he's like, you don't know how to talk to Achilles. He's like a character of literature. You know, you don't understand literature.
And the kid's like, well, I thought we hit it off. Yeah, so he kind of ruins it for himself, but he doesn't realize he's ruining it. And then probably the saddest part is that he's tainting the experience for the kid in real time. You know, you're watching the kid doubt himself. He had this amazing experience that he wanted to share with other people, and he comes back and he does. And then he's just delighted that an adult wants to come along with him because nobody believes him.
Well, it's a fascinating thing. It's like he comes back, nobody believes him, right? And
they punish him.
Yeah, he's like, you're obviously making something up. Go read poetry. That's going to help you. And so this Mr. Snob or Mr. Bonds is like, all right, let's see, what are you talking about? You know, he takes a chance, right? And yeah. So, but when he gets there, he's like, yeah, there's all these great people. Like, you don't know who these people are. Like the driver of this thing, I had to look it up, but apparently it's Dante. This is Dante that's standing here. And you think of him as Dan something. So he's like, you don't know how to appreciate this appropriately. And the kid's like, I was just having fun. I was enjoying it, but you're right. I don't know how to appreciate it appropriately. So like, it's kind of like a disillusion, like you said, right? I thought it was just fun. I thought it was just a wonderful place to go and experience. And that's what I was trying to tell everybody. But you're saying, I'm not doing it right. It's like, you're not reading the literature appropriately.
I think it even goes a little bit beyond fun though, right? Because when he has the scene where he's being punished when he comes back and he has to read the poetry, he has that moment with Mr. Bonds where he's like crying. He's like, poems used to be words for me. Maybe before this would have been a punishment, but now like I've seen this I understand it. And I've reached a different level of understanding and appreciating poetry because now I understand beauty and, you know, like I've matured a little bit. Right. So it's like, yes, he's having fun. He's having a blast. It's like innocent fun in the sense that he can appreciate it and just like look at it and just feel wonder and not want to take some of it for himself. Or the kid is like very much just appreciating and like amazed. And Mr. Bonds is like, all right, well, I have an agenda. I want to go talk to these people and I want them to know that I'm one of them and I appreciate them and I understand them.
Yeah, it's really like as a story, it has you think of a lot of stories, it's like, what does this mean? What's the author trying to tell me about something?
Yeah,
and
right, this one's
like really obvious, right?
Yeah.
This is what allegory does. It's like, you know that this kid represents this particular thing and this character represents this particular thing. It's not a puzzle. It's right there on the surface.
Yeah, and that's a pretty good way to present it if the point is, like you said, that one way you can look at this is that Mr. Bonds is the literary critic, right?
Yeah.
It's like, how else do you want to interpret the Celestial Omnibus? Go ahead, try. You know, like we've made it abundantly clear. Can't we just enjoy the story? Can't this kid just enjoy his bus ride? I do like the section that you read too, the beginning of that section too. It had two horses whose sides were still smoking. Like you can picture this whole scene and the fact that it kind of starts with the kid asking his mom about the sign because the sign says like to heaven. It doesn't say go meet your literary heroes, you know?
Yeah.
It's a little more ominous than that. There's like a little bit of a horror movie element to it, you know? When I was reading this, like I pictured his whole street and his whole world and the house and everything as being like really dark and kind of like run down. And even these horses that show up, it felt like the Headless Horseman or something, you know? Like who's steering these horses and who do they belong to? And just creepy a little bit. And who knows if it's actually like described described that way. It's just like the tone was kind of sad and dark and closed off, right? And you could tell this kid is yearning for something that is literally around the corner on his street.
Yeah, I mean, this is like Edwardian, late Victorian England in a town. I mean, they do talk about his parents live in a part of the neighborhood where it's not quite as bad as it gets, because it says after number 39, the quality of the house has dropped very suddenly, and 64 yeah. had not even a separate servant's entrance. But at the present moment, the whole road looked rather pretty. It's definitely like they're not in the worst condition. It's just ordinary urban.
Yeah, we know enough to say that they're maybe middle class, but like, you know, there's people poorer than them and people much wealthier than them.
Yes.
And they're very aware of their social standing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So point being that when he finally gets there, it's like Wizard of Oz, right? The world is suddenly in color.
The rainbow, the moon rainbow is cool.
Yeah, literally a rainbow. And it's beautiful. And he's just blown away by it. He's just had this like amazing experience. And also like, you know, when he's like hurtling through the air on this like horse drawn whatever, he's like freaking out because he can't pay, you know? He's like, oh God, I messed up. But everyone is like nothing but kind to him. And yeah, Mr. Bonds just ruins it for him. I thought the ending really threw me for a loop.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Was it the Greek?
Yeah. I mean, okay. So like he gets crowned, right? And this felt like Where the Wild Things Are, you know, like the monsters have chosen him kind of.
I have to say, I think that some of this stuff goes beyond me because I'm not as familiar with some of the literature of the era that they're referring to. Like I haven't actually read Dante and I didn't recognize. I looked it up. I was like, who is the second driver in the Celestial Omnibus is what I typed into Google or something like that.
Yeah, I know. I had to look up all these.
Yeah. And like I recognize Shelley in the beginning and Sir Thomas Browne was a name that's familiar to me, but I don't think I've ever read anything of his. Obviously, I know who Dante is, but he's never named.
Right. Yeah, I know. When I read about Dante and like the reviews of this, I was like, what? I don't remember that name.
But I think like some of the stuff that happens, you know, like Achilles and his shield isn't like the fact of the shield is important. Being crowned in this way, there's probably something to that that it's just I'm missing because I'm not familiar with it.
I mean, whether or not it's a metaphor for something else in any of this writing or like refers directly to something, the point is, right, that he's been chosen over Mr. Bonds.
Yeah.
They've decided that like you're the one that we're hoping to impress.
I would say self-chosen. I think Mr. Bonds had all the opportunity in the world to see it, but
yeah. And then so he gets crowned and then Mr. Bonds there's this little like footnote, and when I read it I was like cracking up, where they just find his body on the street the next day, like in the real world again, and he's like
foul play is suspected.
Yeah, he's been shockingly mutilated. I was like, oh my God.
The unfortunate gentleman had apparently been hurled from a considerable height. Foul play is suspected.
Yeah.
And a thorough investigation is pending.
So like this part for me is where it went from like being a story to like a commentary. Because if this was like a story, maybe we would end with the kid being crowned. Or if maybe there would be some sort of comeuppance for Mr. Bonds, where back in the real world, he doesn't feel like being so outspoken anymore, right? Or he's a little scared when he walks down this part of the street. There'd be something
as
to show that there was a change
for him. Yeah.
Yes. And change in the way that we, you know, he deserved to change, right? Because he was being taught a lesson throughout this. And it said he's been killed. And he's been killed so egregiously that it's like kind of like Ian Forster saying, and this is what will happen to you if you criticize my work. You know what I mean? It feels like very pointed beyond, like I said, it doesn't feel like the true ending of the story so much as like a side note to the reader.
Yeah, this whole story feels like, it almost literally is, but it's slightly different. It's like a fairyland kind of story, like where the kid walks into the woods and just enters fairyland. It's like an old 19th century version of what we think of as fantasy stories now, like a portal fantasy or something. But instead of going to fairyland, they go to literature land, right? And fairyland is dangerous. You could die there. People die in fairyland. And I think that's like Mr. Bonds isn't going to make it because he's not made for fairyland. Not like the kid is. He's taking something into it that doesn't belong there.
Yeah.
Which is part of the theme of the whole overarching story.
There's a documentary called Class Action Park. And it's about like a water park in like New Jersey that kids used to die at. Like summer after summer after summer. This is what literature world feels like.
Oh.
like we just don't have any safety precautions in place and we also don't care. Yeah. Sorry, Mr. Bonds. You were over the maximum height. I was going to try to look for like a section, but I don't think I really outlined any. There are moments when I felt like I was reading this and I had to like reread it 3 or 4 times because the writing just felt so almost like Dr. Seuss. Like he was having like fun, it felt like, with some of the turns of phrase.
Oh, I mean, he was definitely having fun, but I think like when Sir Thomas Browne is speaking as the first driver, he's like mimicking Browne's speech, like that 17th century style. And then when Dante is speaking, he's mimicking a Dante style. Is my guess. Like I said, I haven't read these people, but that's what it felt like because it was so different. I mean, the language I stumbled over in the first when I read the section at the beginning of this episode is that kind of 17th century, like who says terrine anymore? I mean, he's trying to tell the boy that he's not just Mr. Brown, he's Sir Thomas Brown. And so he begins by saying, titular pretensions, I know it well, are vanity. Like that's probably the way Sir Thomas Brown wrote, right? And then at the end, when Dante is giving his kind of like, well, he says, Mr. Bonds is saying, like, save me, let me stop in your chariot. I have honored you, I've quoted you, I have bound you in vellum. Take me back to my world. The driver replied, I am the means and not the end. I am the food and not the life. Stand by yourself as that boy has stood. I cannot save you, for poetry is a spirit, and they that would worship it must worship in spirit and in truth. It sounds like the kind of thing that a Dante would have written, knowing what little I know about Dante. It might even echo some specific passage. I don't know for sure. I'm just guessing. That's one of the cool things I like about this story, too, is like the literary characters kind of preserve their literariness.
Yeah, they feel like ghosts or something.
I think I've mentioned it before. There's a, I think it's David Lodge story where one of the characters in the story is running a work, like a writing workshop, and his assignment for the students is to write in the style of some other author. And so one section of the novel is like all the students' submissions to that exercise. And it's a series of stories that are all told in all these different, like you recognize Henry James, you recognize, I don't remember who it was, but like one of them was definitely Henry James, but then there'd be like a Hemingway style and there was some other style. And like you can recognize their styles. And I really like seeing that when authors can include that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting to mimic. I mean, maybe that's how these authors spoke in their books, or maybe it's how they spoke in real life, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, did Hemingway talk the way he wrote? Who knows? But we would recognize it if
That'd be
he talked like
interesting.
one of his characters, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, how do you know? Like Sir Thomas Browne, the only thing that survives is his writing. We don't have recordings.
But either way, like, yeah, they're caricatures of themselves in some way. They're larger than life coming to life so that you recognize them. Trying to think of a takeaway for this one. I guess by the end, especially with that ending, just kind of showing us that Mr. Bonds has been, I'm picturing him like decapitated, right? Hurled from a great height and dead. That like direct commentary, and like we touched on earlier, how obvious it is what E.M. Forster wants us to take away from this.
Yeah.
If there's something that you feel like you want to comment on in society, these kinds of stories work really well. They're really strong, you
Oh,
know?
yeah. Allegory, basically.
Yeah, and I'll remember the bus pretty vividly, and I'll remember that it took him to literature world, and I'll remember that the point was he enjoyed it, you know?
Yeah.
When stories are that like outlandish, and you know that it's just for the purpose of communicating an opinion, they really stick out. Yeah, allegory or anything else. Like I'm just even like certain like fables, you know what I mean? Like we remember things like the tortoise and the hare. It's like the
Yes.
lesson being take your fucking time and finish. It's like whatever the lesson is that you want to communicate, the lesson might not be as memorable as that little vehicle that you package it in, right? And in this case, it's the omnibus and the concept, and that's really vivid, that's really memorable. And then as a result, I'll remember whatever message. Sometimes I think we have to write like really serious stories for a serious message, but they can be fun this way, and they can the little package or plot that you invent can be the memorable thing that like triggers, you know, your thought of the actual message.
Yeah, my takeaway is a little, it's similar to that because I was thinking about this in terms of the author Forster setting up like a dichotomy between the boy and Mr. Bonds as two different ways to react to literature. And then the story sets up a situation in which the situation chooses which is the better version of that reaction. You know, that is a way to set up a story. If you have an idea for a story, like, or an idea for just an idea about the world, you can create characters that think about something differently and then have the story pick one, right? Have the plot of the story is this person wins out because of their perspective on things, and this person loses out. And like, that's like the beginning of how you say something with fiction, how you kind of like move beyond merely telling a story to commenting on life or the world. And it doesn't have to be as obvious and clear cut and purely allegorical as something like this, where you can have complicated characters that are, their differences aren't determinative of like the outcome, but the story can just show them in what their kind of distinctions do to them, like the way in which they interact with the world, how the world responds to them. And that's it can just be a demonstration rather than a lesson, if that, if that makes sense.
And so if this story had taken that advice, they would not have killed Mr. Bonds.
Possibly.
They would have just let him embarrass himself, right? Like, he's so wildly different from the child that we don't need to have any sort of consequence befall him other than just watching how strained those interactions are.
Yeah, him dying is definitely a moral outcome. That story is definitely saying, if you read literature wrong, you should be killed.
I know. It's that's why I was literally cracking up. I was like, I did not expect this. Also, wow, it's a lot.
Yep. Ian Forster was all about the gulag for snobs.
Snobs.
No, not really. But, you know, it can be not as specific as that. It's like, you don't have to have a specific kind of message. Like, you want to say this thing. You just kind of want to explore what it's like to be human, which seems that's what fiction's about, is like kind of portraying humanity. And the one really kind of fertile way to do that, one thing that can generate good stories, is having different kinds of people react to a similar thing, and like the ways they react to it is like where the drama happens, because they're different.
Right. And I'm sure we can think of a million stories that take that lighter approach, and how powerful it is, like you said, just to watch those characters on the page interact. It's almost like you don't have to hit your reader over the head with it, right?
Yeah.
Very good. Well, thanks, guys.
If you enjoyed this episode, consider joining our Patreon. Your support helps us keep the show running. Find out more at patreon.com/whyisthisgoodpodcast. And for industry news, writing tips, and great short fiction, join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/Naples Writers Workshop. You can also subscribe to our monthly newsletter at napleswritersworkshop.com.